Welcome to Teaching Restored, where we are your weekly teacher council meeting. That's right. We're going to talk about how to teach the gospel even better than we have before. I'm Kevin Jones.
And I'm Julie Hilliard. And I'm excited about today, but today is rather specific. And so what I'd like to do is tell you exactly what it's going to be about. And then you can tune out and go to another episode if this doesn't apply to you.
That sounds appetizing. I am so excited.
I'm all about not wasting people's time. Don't you appreciate my efficiency? Okay.
I absolutely do. Yes.
So this is what today is going to be about. If you work with the youth and you are finding difficulty in them connecting with each other, within their quorum, within their class, within their group, and that's creating an obstacle in not just, you know, having a unified class group, et cetera, but also maybe creating an obstacle when it comes to being able to listen and be instructed together, like learn together. And so I'm thinking specifically about Sunday instruction and how challenging it can be if you have a group that isn't connected to and doesn't trust each other.
That is good.
If that is you, keep listening.
Very good.
Is that okay? Pretty
That's
specific?
That's great. Let's do this. Let's dive in.
See, he didn't know the topic, so I figured I ought to maybe even introduce it for Kevin so that we know what we're talking about. Okay, so the reason that this is on my mind is because a few weeks ago, I was asked to teach in Young Women's, and the Young Women's president said specifically, she's like, okay, I want to take 2 weeks, and we're not even going to touch Come Follow Me. We're not going to touch a lesson. I want to talk about relationships among these girls, because she said that one of the things that she was most concerned about was what she would observe on our Tuesday night mutual activities, or just, is it called mutual anymore?
No.
What's it called?
Activity night? I don't know. That's a good question.
Activity night.
There you go.
So, anyway, what she was observing was that there would be these, you know, opportunities for them to be chatting amongst themselves. And a few of the young women would go and isolate themselves, or they would talk on the side, and then you'd see somebody be left out. And then when it came to the class, my own daughter was, you know, coming and saying, Mom, nobody talks. There's one person who talks, and then nobody else ever talks in class. And so she's like, I don't want to say anything. She's like, it feels weird. And so I'm like, well, why don't you just, you know, lead out by example, participate. We've had all those conversations. Right. She's like, no, that's not going to happen. She's like, it just doesn't feel comfortable to share. And so I thought, huh, that's so interesting. And then as this young women's president was talking to me, I kind of put two and two together, and I started to think a little bit about how important trust is in a classroom. And when you think about it, you know, we don't often have opportunities outside of church to really get to know the people that we're in a learning environment with. You know, if you're doing continuing education for your profession, you know, you're usually, you know, you're going to be like, yo, we have the same profession, bonded, whatever. But when you are in a church setting and you are being asked questions that require you to reflect, require you to reveal intimate thoughts and feelings, which is really a lot of what the gospel of Jesus Christ is. If you don't trust the people that are sitting in that room, you're not going to talk. And I think that as adults, we can sometimes get past some of that. And we even give like little fake phony answers just to help keep the discussion moving. And we kind of just throw our two cents in because we want to be a good learner and we're trying to be supportive of the teacher. But if you are a youth and you value authenticity, which is what our youth feel today, like that is a high, high priority for them. They value authenticity. They value respect for each other. Even, you know, there's this kind of paradigm in the world right now that is creeping its way into their framework, and they're trying to figure out how to muddy through all of this, that we need to respect, you know, respect all kinds of diversity. And if there is any kind of bigotry or unkindness, like they just bristle in a way that we wouldn't necessarily have been as sensitive to in the past. Not because we're insensitive people necessarily, but because the culture wasn't the way that it is now. And so they are being raised in this environment that we don't totally understand because it's so different from our own, but that we need to respect because it is their reality. And that is one of just being kind of accepting and kind to everyone. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it's just in the words that you say, not necessarily in all of your actions. But do you see what I'm trying to get out here? I'm trying to describe that their paradigm, their framework for interpreting the world socially is very different from ours. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we just have two boys left at home right now. And so I felt like over the years, when we rate, so our first three kids, and then our next three kids, and then our next two boys, each of those groups had to be raised totally differently. Okay. And typically people don't have as many children as we do. And so they have
a lot of kids.
Right. So, you know, there's not like phases. There's like, I raised my kids. Well, it's, we raised almost three groups of kids, and they were different in culture. And we had to change every single time that we talked about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, how to use this, how not to use this. You know, is that even a thing anymore? And so, yes, it's very different, not only than what we were, but just 5, 10, 20 years ago as well.
Think about For the Strength of Youth. Think about how that has changed. Think about missionary work, from the Little White Handbook to Preach My Gospel. Like, there have been things that have evolved. And if part of what we as adults who are at a different age, I'm so sorry, you have to embrace that you are a different age than the youth you are teaching.
Where you're different aged.
Different aged. That we have to think a little bit differently when we're with them. And so one of the reasons that I really think that this whole idea of having unity in your quorums and classes and stuff like that is probably more important with this generation of youth than it even was for us. And I think that it becomes a pretty significant obstacle in their ability to learn the gospel, in their ability to share real feelings, and their ability to process what truth means to them, and the safe space, creating a safe space for them to do it, is all contingent on there being unity within those groups. Right. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, yes. I like this.
Okay, so I started, as she kind of gave me this assignment, you know, my favorite thing to talk about, which I've said probably a billion times, has to do with communication. And so that was one of the reasons she wanted me to bring some real skills to these girls. And so that was part of the discussion, but we had to introduce it a little bit. And as I started to kind of think a little bit about their reality, I want to kind of walk through what I decided to do, because what I'm hoping is that the ideas that we share today and that we discuss today will be something that any youth leader might be able to do their own version of.
That's great.
In their own classes. And if not do their own version of it, at least create some awareness of, you know, do we have good relationships among these youth? Is there something that we need to be looking for that we could do differently? And so maybe just seeking a little bit more instruction from the Spirit in terms of focusing on those relationships. So great. To be clear, our job is not to be the party planner when we are in a youth calling. Our job is also not to be their best friend.
Wait, hold on.
I know.
You are smashing like two major paradigms of so many leaders that I've seen in the past and even currently, that we're here to entertain the youth and be their best friend, right?
So that they what? Like us? No, Kevin, we're wrong. We're naughty. We're not doing it. We're naughty. So our job is really to do everything that we can to help them come closer to Christ. And in some cases, it's helping remove obstacles so that they can come closer to Jesus. It's not being an obstacle because their relationship with us gets in the way. Mm-hmm. It's not even inserting ourselves into the equation when it's not even about us.
Right.
So instead of taking everything personally, it's kind of actually about getting out of the way and helping to create as much opportunity as we possibly can for them to have experiences with the Spirit.
Good.
And so with that paradigm, contention, disunity, discomfort, a lack of trust, all of those things will be obstacles in them being able to fill the Spirit and get closer to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's remove the obstacle, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this is how I kind of started it. And I may have shared this before on a podcast. I can't remember. I know that I shared it when we did the Leading Saints. Like we did, Kevin and I reviewed some conference talks with Leading Saints. Yes. And I know I did it then. I just can't remember if I've done it on this podcast before, but it may be a rerun. So I'm sorry if it is.
Do again.
So years ago, I used to work in the prison and I was teaching classes to male inmates and I was teaching at the level right below maximum security. And in that setting, I had a lot of really interesting experiences, but specifically there were a lot of men that had committed some pretty ugly crimes. In the level right below maximum security, you had people who had murdered or who had been involved in gangs and committed a crime related to gang violence and oftentimes resulted in somebody else's death. And a lot of them were never going to get out of prison. And my job was to go in and teach a life skills class that would help them develop skills that they could apply right then in, you know, so that they could have a better life in prison. So
no
that
pressure.
They could, I know, right? But the idea is also that if you ever did get out, hopefully the life skills would help to reduce the recidivism rate so that you didn't come back to prison. Right. And so one of the things that was really interesting at the very beginning of the class, we did this little experiment. And the point of the experiment is to illustrate the idea that what we think about unconsciously influences our behavior. And so this is what we did. We took this little washer. Kevin, you've seen me do this before, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Yeah. So this is a little washer and you can do this super easily with your kids. You basically are tying a piece of twine to a washer, okay? And you have them hold it up so that the washer is right in front of their eyes. And then you ask them in their mind so first of all, hold it still, get it so that it's still, right? Hanging there still. Mm-hmm. And then ask them to focus on the washer with their eyes and think right, left, right? And you can see that it starts to kind of move, right? And right. I'm not focusing, like I'm not saying move my hand right and left, but what the point is that what you think about influences your behavior without you actually even paying attention to the behavior. So then to prove the point, you can have them hold it again and focus on it, make it still, right? And then think front, back. Okay. I have a very powerful.
Which it is doing. Yes.
It is doing. And so I promise you, I'm not doing that on purpose. You can go experiment with this yourself before you do it in class. But the point that you're trying to make is that what we think about unconsciously influences our behavior. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of bring up the idea of, well, what do you think about other people? And, you know, kind of start to think about, you know, if it's your best friend, what are some of the first adjectives that pop into your mind, you know, versus somebody that annoys the snot out of you? Mm-hmm. What are the first adjectives that pop into your mind? Well, if what you think about unconsciously influences your behavior, ooh, maybe sometimes we don't even realize it, but what we think about another person comes across to them. And so that's a really significant thing when it comes to relationships. You think about if somebody kind of feels this feeling of irritation, frustration, a lack of trust, like some of the words when I ask these young women, you know, what is the first thing that comes to mind when you think about this person that you don't like? And some of them were like liar, hypocrite, you know, rude, I don't trust her, you know, so those types of things started coming out. And I'm like, wow, if you are thinking in your mind, liar, and then she does something that's not actually a lie, but doesn't make sense to you, you might go, oh, reinforced that. And then you're kind of bristling every time you're talking to that person. So the idea is, if what you think about unconsciously influences your behavior, it's really important to get good information into your mind about other people. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I started talking to them about, okay, so if, hold on one second, I want to just make sure. Oh, I said, what, tell me one thing that you want other people to know about you. And I went around the room.
Okay.
And I had all of them share something that they wanted other people to know about them. And I thought, you know, it's so interesting because it's not very often that you get the opportunity to just like brag on yourself, right? But there are certain things that you're proud of and certain things that you want other people to know about you. But under what circumstances are you likely to share about yourself? What has to happen for you to be willing to share about yourself?
Well, I think the other, if I'm going to say something about myself, I'm not going to say it unless I think someone else is listening. And, okay. And that I'm safe to say it because I don't want to, like last night. So I met this guy. We were at this ward function. This guy, not even from our ward, came in and he said, so we were talking about different places we lived. He said, yeah. And he found out we had moved to Alabama. And he said, well, why did you move to Alabama? Was it work? And there's no real good way to say this, to say what I'm about to say with, I just kind of have to say it, right? I mean, so I said, he asked, was it work? And I said, yes, I was consulting with NASA. And he was like, oh, that was the biggest flex I've ever seen. Wow. And I was like, no, dude. There's no good way to say that. It just is what it is. I'm not trying to brag. You asked and I told you, and he's like, oh, wow. And I was like, no. And so I've thought about that ever since. I mean, just last night, I've thought about it like 15 times about, okay, can I say that any differently? Can I say it? I'm not trying to brag, but, and those are the kind of things where I, you know what? Okay. I don't want to say anything now, but if I do, but if I feel safe with them, I can just say it and not care.
Yeah,
because I know that they will take it the right way as well. So I trust them. I trust their mental state with me, et cetera.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Kevin, that I get it. Like, that's so awkward.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that was the last thing I was trying to do. Right. And then you just feel stupid. And then you're right. like, how do you respond to that? Oh, that was the biggest flex I've ever seen. Oh, awkward. Okay. Your point is super well made. So you have to trust. You have to believe that they're genuinely interested. So you have to believe that they're going to listen to you, right? Like you said, that listen. And I think that means, like, people will ask, I probably shouldn't say this, but Todd, like, sometimes when he gets home from work, he'll be like, so how was your day? And I feel like it's just for the sake of asking me that. And I'm like, he doesn't really give a rip. And so I won't, I'm like kind of, I don't care. He doesn't really care. And so I don't give him a real answer.
Sure.
He's my husband, for crying out loud.
Right.
But we have to feel like the person is genuinely interested in what it is that we're going to say, if we're going to share anything about ourselves.
Yep.
And so it's not just people asking, but it's people, because they do have to ask. I mean, there has to be some kind of a question. You don't just like start flexing without a question, right? I mean, come on.
Right.
So there has to be some kind of a question, but then we have to believe that they actually are interested and that we can trust them with that information. And I think those are two huge things. Tell me what you think some of the other obstacles might be from the perspective of youth. Why do you think they might struggle specifically to share with each other? Now, but let me be clear, not just things that they want other people to know, just in general. Like, why is it difficult to share with each other?
What they want other people to know?
Not just, because remember how I said where I said, what's one thing you want people to know about you? So take it a step further. If it's, we're talking right now about obstacles of sharing something you actually want people to know. Well, remember, you're not just in your life going to be sharing things that you want people to know about you. Oftentimes, what you're sharing is actually hard for you to share. You don't want people to know about it, or you're asked a question that gets at something that you're not super comfortable with, or that you're not sure really what to do with. And so think about those types of questions. If it's hard to share things you want people to know because you want them to be interested, you want to make sure they're actually listening to you, you want to make sure they trust you, what are some of the even, you know, more obstacles, I guess you would say, to sharing when it's something that you're not even comfortable sharing?
Here are a few things that I just thought of. First off, I wouldn't want it to be taken in a way that would be abused.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
I have seen, and this happens with everyone. I mean, it can happen with adults as well, where you say something about yourself and they take it complete, well, like the flex thing, right? They take it completely the wrong way and they abuse it. And you think, no, that's not what. And then it becomes, you know, especially with teenagers, then it becomes a part of who you are in the collective eye of everyone else.
Okay. So let me, when you said abuse it, what you might be also saying is that you don't trust that it won't be thrown back in your face.
Well, that could be part of it. Yeah. I mean, maybe not necessarily thrown back in your face, but everything that you reveal about yourself in a way for other people helps them create this kind of mold of who you are. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And if you say one thing, you may say, okay, this is a weakness of mine. Well, then they may blow that weakness up. No. That's okay. It is, but you know, I mean, and then it becomes a way of looking at you.
Yes.
That you didn't intend for it to happen.
So in other words, it becomes something that defines maybe other people's perception of you, or gets blown out of proportion, or gets taken out of context, or is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah. Am I revealing my inner teenager?
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. So add some more complexity to that. Okay. It may not be revealed or whatever, just in a conversation with another person, or, you know, a collective group of people all of a sudden may know about it. So in other words, people may share what you share with them with other people, but we add a whole nother level when it comes to social media.
Yes.
You know, that what if, I mean, these kids are afraid sometimes that their conversations are being recorded and that they're going to get posted somewhere.
Right.
So not only are they worried about, you know, you can't have these, you don't have the same types of in-person conversations that you used to have because of social media. And so it's almost like they aren't practiced at what it is to have a private conversation that stays private. Mm. And like, it's not the habit.
That's a good point.
Everything is public. Mm-hmm. And so like, as I started thinking about this, some of the answers that they gave me surprised me a little bit. Like they were things I hadn't really thought of. And so instead of, you know, sharing all of those, I would invite you to ask them, what are some of the reasons that you aren't comfortable sharing with other people? And I think you'll be surprised. I thought I could have anticipated the answers, and the ones that you and I came up with, they're great, but they didn't totally match the answers that I got from them.
Interesting.
So instead of, like I said, expanding that, ask that question. Because if you can understand why they don't share with each other, that's another thing that you can do to help either teach a skill that will help them be able to feel more comfortable doing that, or create an experience where you break down some of those barriers. They have to have successful experiences sharing with each other to feel safe doing it. Right?
Okay. It almost seems though, Julie, that this is kind of, you're kind of working against yourself but maybe not. Tell me if I'm wrong in this.
Yeah, tell me.
You're asking them to share why they won't share. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
So why are they going to share something that they wouldn't share? I mean, does that make sense?
You know what is so interesting, Kevin? This is so interesting to me. I totally agree with you. Why would they share something that they don't want to share? It is so easy for them to talk about reasons they won't do something. So like my daughter, for example, is in this class, right? And at the end of this class, she said to me, Mom, people talked more in this class than I've ever had people talk in a young women's lesson. And so part of what you're doing when you're saying, why is it hard for you to share? You're not saying, come on guys, share with me. You're saying, you don't want to share. I can see that you don't want to share. Why not? That's so different.
Interesting. Sure. I could see that.
Like it was weird. And I agree with what you're saying. I think that the thing, like I have mentioned this before too, and this is something I totally believe in, that when you ask them to talk about their life and things that happened at school that week, and, you know, just kind of like have a chat conversation, you can't get them to shut up. Right.
Right.
And so when you ask them about something that they're kind of interested in, you're not necessarily asking them to reveal something about themselves, but you are, because you can say, why do people in general struggle to share with each other? And then they'll start going, well, it becomes more personal. but it doesn't feel quite as intimidating. Maybe if you take one step back and say, why do people sometimes want to share? Mm-hmm. So, but it's weird. It's almost like they want to say, well, this is why I'm not speaking up in class. And then throwing other people under the bus a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
I could see that happening. Sure.
I mean, it kind of does. So yeah. You're right. It feels like you're shooting yourself in the foot. But when you ask them questions like this, you're like, come on. Why is it hard to share? That's I had great. No problem getting answers. Mm. So seems weird. I know. So this is what I kind of talk to them about. I'm like, there are two ways that we get to know each other. Like we get to know each other by asking questions and then someone sharing information. Like it's just this really, really simple thing, but it requires two skills of us. There's put it in the camera. In the frame. Skill number one is that we have to ask good questions that people are going to feel comfortable sharing. And skill number two is what you got out at the very beginning. We have to listen to the answers. We have to show genuine interest. And both of those things are really hard for these youth. They have not practiced asking questions. And one of the things that came out that I thought was really interesting, and my 17-year-old had actually pointed this out to me before, he said, and this was so interesting to me. I don't relate to this. You tell me what you think. We talked to him about, like, he was struggling in some relationships, some friendships that he had. And we talked to him about the importance of asking people about themselves instead of just like bragging on yourself and sharing information about yourself, because that's what they think they need to do to get, you know, validation back or to get, you know, people to like them. They have to like put good stuff out there that people like, and then they'll like them. Sure. That's like this teenage paradigm. But instead we're like, well, what if you were to actually take a genuine interest in other people and ask some questions about themselves? He's like, they'll think I'm stupid. Nobody does that. Nobody asks each other questions. And I'm like, what? Does that like what?
How that's what I said. You get to know and, other people.
Right? So in this group of young women, they're like, we don't do that. If you start asking people questions, they're gonna think you're weird.
What?
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 What? So this is the thing, Kevin. Like, this is so interesting to me. But in their world, it is almost foreign to sit and have a conversation where you take a genuine interest in someone else. Like, how is that even possible? I don't know. But then if you watch these youth, they have surface conversations and one person will drop a nugget, another person will drop a nugget, another person will drop a nugget, but nobody builds on each other's nuggets that they're dropping. Like if you were to tell me something about yourself, they're bad nuggets.
No, they're a pile of nuggets.
Pile of nuggets. But like maybe nuggets is the wrong word. It's like picturing like, I'm not sure, like little, whatever, chunks of something. But it's like you throw something out there and my inclination would be to, oh, Kevin just said this. I want to like talk about it. But they don't. They just throw their next little thing in. And it's like a pile of information.
Whoa.
So have you observed this ever, or is this kind of, because I hadn't really thought about it. But then as I've been like the driver in the car listening to teenagers in the back seat, or as I've been at youth group eavesdropping on conversations, they don't know how to really take a genuine interest in each other.
I've never thought of that before. And that's now that I'm thinking back to conversations that I hear my teenagers have. Yeah. I mean, when was there a lengthy conversation about someone or something without, I mean, I could see someone, some of my teenagers, I have lengthy conversations about things, but it's still nuggets. You could say just their piece on it. And it doesn't actually dive into it at all. There isn't any meat or substance to it. It's a whole bunch of fluff thrown on each other.
Yes.
You're right. Oh my.
Okay, so listen to this. And when you think about this, and it's possible I don't have this right. I'm not suggesting that I for sure am getting this right, but it is an observation. And I think that part of the problem is not, so part of the problem is that they don't really think about trying to see things from another frame of reference. And so what they do is they drop out, this is my frame of reference. And then the other person goes, this is my frame of reference. And then the other person, and nobody takes the opportunity to try and see it from the other person's frame of reference. And so when you think about what empathy literally is trying to see an experience from another person's frame of reference. You're trying to understand how they see it. Mm-hmm. But if you are only focused on your own frame of reference, then you're like, this is my frame of reference. Well, this is my frame of reference. Well, this is my frame of reference. Well, this is mine. And you're just dropping nuggets.
Right.
Is this resonating at all? Are you seeing what I'm seeing a little bit, maybe?
Yes. Okay. Let me throw something out that it's starting to connect.
Okay.
We have a daughter in the MTC right now. And they in the MTC, I don't know, actually she's in the Mexico City MTC. And I don't know if it's just there or if it's in every MTC or if it goes out to the missions yet. I haven't figured this out yet. But they have this emotional chart to where mm-hmm. they're supposed to say, how are you emotionally this week? Are you green and you're doing well? Yellow, you know, things are good, but, you know, kind of tough. Orange, wow, I'm not sure I like this. Red, I want to go home.
Okay. And this is for the missionaries to ask each other?
This is for the missionaries to report to leadership.
Okay.
About their emotional state for that week and how things have been going. Basically, if you have 3 days of orange, you should go talk to the mission president. Okay. And red is definitely like we need to get you in now. Let's have a discussion, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of orange and red, it has been unbelievable that she has told us. I mean, it is just orange and red and orange and red and orange and red. For she personally, she says, I'm green. I may hit a few days of yellow, but I'm happy and I'm loving this and everything. But there are others who are constantly in the yellow and orange. And this whole, your discussion about the whole frame of reference, I wonder if they had the tools to understand what they're doing from other frames of references, other missionaries' points of mm-hmm. reference, that they wouldn't be so much in the orange and red anymore. If they mm-hmm. could, because they, it wouldn't be about them. For example, right now, they're just learning how to be missionaries, right? Yeah. They're having some mock discussions, but are they really getting in? Are they really learning how to dive into you, person? I want to know about you. Right. I'm going to throw my nuggets out right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And my nugget is I'm feeling this way. But if they're looking at it from a different perspective, I wonder if that would be any different. And I'm not saying that that is the cause, but very possibly could be a part of that.
So it may not be the cause, but could it be the cure? So let me throw something else.
Right. Into my
head. Like I'm thinking about Ammon as a missionary. Okay. So you have Ammon. This is Ammon who chopped off the arms. And we say chopped off the arms. And I heard this week that maybe that meant like their armors, like they're not just their actual, but that maybe arms was referring to weapons. And I was sad. Anyway.
Because you had pictured this bloody mess and you were excited about that.
Yes. And I always pictured the bag of arms that came back to King Lamoni. So anyway.
Wow. Okay. There's another thought.
I digressed. I'm back. So one of the things that I learned about missionary work from Ammon is the power of service, right? You watch how he was a servant to King Lamoni. Lamoni was inspired by that. He was almost confused by that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So here is Ammon, and he's saying, what does King Lamoni need? And then he chops off the arms, and the other servants take it back to the king and brag on Ammon, and Ammon's off, you know, preparing the chariots, because he's like, what does Lamoni do next? And so his whole thought was about another person and trying to mm-hmm. anticipate Lamoni's needs from within Lamoni's frame of reference. And I think that part of what happens to us is that what we feed grows. And so when we are emotionally not in a great state and we are thinking about ourselves, we are feeding our not great emotional state.
Sure.
Versus when we can actually look at somebody else and invest in them and what's going on with them, all of a sudden, that burden that we're feeling somehow, I mean, this is the miracle of charity, right? You have the true love of Jesus Christ that when you are trying to show love to other people, you then become filled with. Mm. And so I think that one of the cures to like this difficult kind of weight that we sometimes bear emotionally, like when we talk to these young women, for example, I know that some of them have OCD, depression, anxiety, social anxiety, like they have mental health issues, chemical imbalances, things that they are struggling with that weigh them down and that place a burden on them and that make it difficult for them to invest in other people. And in no way do I want to minimize the chemical aspect of that. And in order to cope with difficult mental health issues, one of the things that is prescribed, in addition to medication when needed, is service, is trying to look at other people, trying to invest in other people. And so when you think about what you just said, I think you are making that point so beautifully that what we think about influences our behavior. If what we are thinking about has to do with other people and our focus is on investing in them, we are less focused on us, our own discomfort, what we don't want to share, the reasons we don't want to share, et cetera. We become able to engage because our focus shifts to them. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So here's part of the skill aspect of it. So I went around with these girls and I said, what's a question that you could ask someone just to show interest? And they popped off several questions, but it took a minute. And so they were good questions just about, you know, what's your favorite sport? What's your favorite? This, like, I think of them as the, when you're at college and you meet people, do you remember like that slew of about 16 questions that you could just pop through if you were trying to know someone really fast? It's kind of like that. And then I said, okay, so what about some follow-up questions? And I picked one of the questions and I said, now tell me follow-up questions that you could ask to that question. And they're like, follow-up questions? I'm like, yeah, dive deeper. They had no problem coming up with a whole bunch. They came up with a ton of follow-up questions. And I'm like, was that hard? And they're like, no, not really. It's not hard, but they just don't think to do it.
Would that be creepy to them though?
So that's the thing they did say, wouldn't it be kind of creepy? Are you being like a stalker? And I'm like, no, this is called genuine interest. And so you're not like pummeling them. It's not the grand inquisition. I said, here's the key. The key is not in how many questions you ask. The key is the way in which you respond to their answers. So for example, somebody shares a little bit of information in response to a question you've asked. And you're like, oh, cool. You can even repeat back what they said to you. And then you can ask them a follow-up question just to keep the conversation going. The goal is to show genuine interest. And if the next natural question helps to show genuine interest, your face should reflect it. Your body language should reflect it. And this is a huge thing we talked about. We said, okay, so think about this. Stupid phone, right? If you are having a conversation with someone and you ask them a question and then your phone lights up and they see it and your eyeballs glance, what do they immediately think?
They're not listening.
Yep. So you need to take this and it needs to be in your pocket. It needs to be face down somewhere. That is a rule of a conversation because the minute your eyes divert to the light that just popped up on your phone, you have not shown genuine interest in that person. And I actually did something so naughty, but I said, how do you think your body language has told me you feel about this lesson? And I said, you know, tell me a little bit about that. Like, think about you, I'm watching you and we're talking together. And what are the things that you have done with your body to show interest or disinterest? And whether or not you were actually interested Your body language told me you weren't. When you took out your phones, when you whispered to your neighbor, when you slouched, when you kind of started looking through whatever, when you were genuinely interested, how did you show me with your body language? And they were like, oh crap, but they got it. Mm-hmm. And so part of what you're saying is, if you want to show genuine interest in another person, not only do you have to ask questions, but then you have to respond appropriately with interest when they give you an answer. And there are so many things that we do that botch it. And how does that make a person feel? I said, lucky for you, I'm not sensitive. So don't worry about it. I'm not like trying to get mad at you or anything. But I said, what about the person who's just told you a little something about like the fact that their parents are getting divorced and you're like, oh crap. And you looked at your phone. Like, you're like, no, I promise I'm interested. I just was waiting for a text from such and such.
Mm-mm. Lost.
Lost. Lost. And so you having that type of conversation dialogue is huge. And you doing it, like the skills that go into doing it, we are so kind of oblivious to, and our habits actually sabotage our efforts sometimes because they're bad habits.
Right.
So any thoughts before I have one more point that I kind of want to make?
So I love this topic. I love that you brought this up. I love that you pointed this out. There's only one thing I don't love.
Tell me about it.
This is not just for teenagers. Mm-mm. This is adults too. We can't live at this. You're saying all this and I'm thinking, I'm seeing this more and more in the adults. Yeah. As well. I've seen these kind of conversations. I've seen the phone thing obviously is a big thing among everyone. Mm-hmm. I think the nugget thing, I see that more and more. So I think these skills are not just dealing with teenagers, but this could be used with adults as well.
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying. I 100% agree. I just think that it is like we sometimes don't give youth enough credit to say that they can actually learn these skills.
That's great.
And I think they can. Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
So let me get back to the very beginning and then I'll just share one kind of thought that I threw out to this group. So taking it back to the very beginning, if what we think about unconsciously influences our behavior, we need to be looking for good things about each other. And the best, like they say, and I totally agree with this, that the people that you know the best, you like the most. Like the people that you have issues with, you really don't know that well usually.
Sure.
And so I think that the best way that we can get good thoughts to unconsciously influence our behavior in a positive way is simply to get to know people better. And so that's why I suggested these two skills of being able to ask questions and take a genuine interest in someone and then reflect that interest in the way you respond back to them. And so that type of engagement will help you to really like people better. Like you will like people better the more you know about them. The opposite is almost never true, that you like them less the more that you know about them, unless they're a serial killer and then you decide that you might not like their behavior. But most of the time, that is true. Okay. Do you want me to share my last thought or do you have a thought? I can't
help. No. Well, boy, I'm putting this into practice mentally, at least in my own life as well. And you're right. Once you get to know more and more, those things that you may, or that I'll say I, the things that I may look at someone and say, annoying, you're annoying, dude. Once I come to get to know them more and I understand it, it's, oh, well, okay, I get it now. Or yeah. I guess I kind of have the same thing anyways, don't I? Or a lot of other things, right? And I'm much more forgiving and much more or less judgmental. But you're right. Once we have those conversations and get to know them more, I think you're right, the more we like them.
Right. I definitely think that's true. Like I think about, I really have very few people in my life that I don't like. But I have this neighbor who is like writes me the most scathing text messages. And I have bent over backwards to be nice to this neighbor.
Of which I have heard some of those text messages.
I know.
And they are, and I will attest to them. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Like he just verbally vomits on me all the time. And you know what's so interesting? Like I can let that roll off. But every time it happens, it kind of makes my heart pound because I'm not used to people like despite and being that so directly rude. Do you know what I mean? I think that people feel like they give themselves permission to say things they wouldn't necessarily say in person when they're saying it in a text message. Right. And so he's given himself permission to verbally vomit all over me. I just want to go get to know him. Like, I think I figured out where he lives. And I think I have, like, I think I just, I'm like, oh, I should go visit. And there's still something hesitant in me, but I think that if I got to know them and if he got to know me, like it, you can't give yourself permission to think these horrible thoughts about someone once you know them. So there's this part of me that's like, maybe I should do that. Mm. Does that make sense? Like it's really, there are very few people in my life where it's that type of kind of weird. And like I said, I've really done my best to be kind, but I'm like, I think if we just got to know each other, it wouldn't be that difficult.
Right. So. And you know, I've actually done that very thing. I remember there was someone who obviously did not like me and I could not figure out what the heck is going on.
Yeah.
And so I went to go to get to know them. And it wasn't quite in this frame of reference, but it was pretty much what I was doing. And they lightened up big time.
It's awesome.
Because we got to know each other. And it works. It does.
You humanize people. Like we do write these clever stories about other people where, you know, they're villains or, you know, just whatever. And you just can't, like, they become reasonable and rational, or at least they become a human being with human emotions that you have some empathy for.
Right.
Once you get to know them better, even if you don't necessarily condone their behavior and they still act like a jerk.
Okay.
You have a little understanding about it.
How about this one?
Okay.
Judas. I wonder if we got to know him and what circumstances he was in and what the pressures were and his thought patterns and everything, where we would go, I get it. I don't agree. I could see how that would happen. I feel sorry, but I get it. Rather than dork. What? Who would ever do that? Biggest loser, right?
So you have talked about this before. Like you've kind of written this movie, right? But you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the passion play in Oberammergau.
Oh, yes.
That they do every, you know, however
10
long.
Years.
Every 10 years. And I went to go see that. And you went to go see it, I think, the year before, the same year. Same year, obviously, because it was every decade. And I walked away with that with so much compassion for Judas. Like the way that the story was told highlighted for me some of the wrestle, some of the emotion of Judas. It was kind of an interesting experience to feel different feelings towards him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as I mentioned in a previous one, my son and I have gone through different versions of what Judas may have been like. And we're like, oh, well, okay. And we started getting to know him without getting to know him. Different versions of him, right? Different realities of him. And it was really, really interesting. And I've found that when I get unhappy with someone, let's say, I mean, just the simple fact that you're driving, someone does something on the road, I'm like, what the heck? My wife is saying something along the lines of, well, maybe they're just having a bad day, or maybe someone just from the hospital, they just died, or, you know, oh, okay. Then you could be a little bit more forgiving in that. But if that were to happen actually with a real person and dive in, then you're right. Totally change the relationship and the understanding.
Right. So, okay. So with that, here's a very practical idea. Okay. So I was saying my prayers the morning before this class, and I was just asking Heavenly Father to really guide my mind and my thoughts so that I could be clear and make the points that He wants me to make. And I had something pop into my head, And I definitely feel like this was a little, you know, a little bit of a little note from the spirit. And I had the thought of a seating chart in my head. And I'm like, seating chart. And then this vision of exactly how it needed to go. And so I got all the girls and I made them stand up at the front of the classroom. And I had the relief site or the young women's president come and I had her sit down first and she just took a chair. And then I had numbered them before they stood up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, all the way to whatever number. And I said, okay, number two, where are you inclined to go sit and why? And she said, over there, because I want to make sure that I have room for so-and-so, my best friend. I'm like, good point. I said, how do you think Sister Martinez feels when she's the only person in there and you don't go sit by her? You know, does it even cross her mind? You know, does she go, oh, she wants to save a seat for Ella, her best friend? Or does she go, oh, guess she didn't want to sit by me, you know? And so I said, where should you go sit? And she went and sat by Sister Martinez. And then I said, okay, person three. She's like, same instinct. I'm like, where do you think you ought to go sit? And I said, not by the girl you were sitting by before, because 1, 2, 3, 4, right? She was sitting next to her before. So sit on the other side of Sister Martinez. And so she did. And I had everybody basically fill in that way. And they went and sat next to the person that was already there. And it didn't matter in what order, you know, or whatever, but the idea was that this is their new seating chart. And I said, every week when you come into class, I want you to go and pick a seat next to a person. And if it happens to be your best friend, fine. But I want you to intentionally aim to pick a seat by someone that you want to get to know better. I said, but regardless, if you don't know anyone in there, just don't leave a gap. Don't leave even a seat. Go sit on their saddlebags. Like sit next to the person right next to them and turn to them and ask them a question. And so that became kind of our seating chart. And that I hope, I really hope, will be the culture of that group. I said, please hold yourselves accountable. This is your new seating chart. And that's so, great. I mean, I don't know, that was just a couple of weeks ago, but it was just, I thought, what an interesting idea. It didn't come from me, like I said. But I really like, and I like the idea of me holding myself accountable for doing the same thing when I walk into any, you know, any room.
Right.
I'll sit by someone. Don't leave a gap. Think about how they feel when you leave a gap.
Because I'll tell you, when I go sit down in a group like that, my thought isn't around how do other people feel. My thought is, I need to leave a little space. I need to be... I want to kind of be by myself maybe, or, hey, I see Julie over there. I'm going to go sit next to Julie and Todd over there. Or, but it's not around, oh, look at so-and-so, or it isn't about other people.
It's so about you.
I know I'm in the orange at that point, right?
Yeah, right.
I need to get out of it. I need to start thinking about more other people in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. Anyway, just a little practical nugget.
More nuggets.
So much about nuggets today. I don't know why.
That's our favorite word today. Nuggets.
The word of the
Sesame Street. That's right.
Just Sesame Street. There you go. Word of the day.
Word of the day is nuggets. Thank you. I'm going to be thinking about this one for a long time, I think. And it's going to change the way I do things. And I'm going to be very uncomfortable doing some of these things. But at the same time, the youth that I work with, I think I'm going to try some of these things too.
Do it. But we got it starts with us. Like we got to all hold ourselves accountable for doing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. Oh, good stuff. Thank you. All right. If you liked this episode, please like, share, subscribe, do all that good stuff. Leave a comment in the podcast. Leave a review if you would. We would absolutely love that. That helps us expand the audience to help more people become better teachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you have a question about how do I do this? We've been getting some of those questions lately in our inbox. Okay, this is what I'm dealing with in my class. How do I do this? Or, you know, as a parent, what do I do? TeachingRestore.com. Drop us a note. Let us know because we'd be happy to look at those and even do an episode on them. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Julie. Great thoughts. Bye.
Bye.